Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal and community well-being and everything going on in our total environment. We talk about the health of our communities, the health of our healthcare system, the health and environmental balance of our society and planet Earth. And each week on the show, we talk to different thought leaders, advocates, organizers, filmmakers, journalists, book authors, and many, many more. And today, we're going to be talking to a candidate. I'm very excited. Our guest today is Carrie Evelyn Harris, and Carrie is running for senator as a progressive Democrat in the state of Delaware. Carrie Harris is a veteran, an advocate, and a community organizer whose life has been dedicated to public service. And actually, there's going to be an upcoming primary occurring in Delaware on September 6th. And we have reported in the past on the show about the progressive agenda and advancing it for a whole host of different reasons. And we'll also be talking about both Carrie's specific race, as well as what progressives like Carrie, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others have to offer to our current dilemmas in the larger body politic, where obviously we're having a really serious problem. So I am delighted to welcome Carrie Evelyn Harris to Connect the Dots. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you for that amazing intro. I appreciate it.
You know, let's begin kind of with that. You know, a lot of people are kind of, you know, we're caught in a dilemma. We have this terrible devolutionary agenda that's being driven by the Republican Party. We have a leader that many people revile, really, distrust, yes, dislike. We don't like what he's doing. And, you know, so I think the basic question when you have a Democrat versus Democrat primary challenge, such as the one you're running in Delaware, you know, the question in some people's minds is, you know, should we, is the best strategy really for taking back control for the people and leading our government and our policies down the pathway that will really defeat and derail this awful agenda and be most helpful to the most people? How can that be served by, for example, a progressive win in your state of Delaware? Is it that, you know, some people are afraid that having, you know, a Democrat challenging another Democrat is going to, like, you know, completely undermine our ability to derail the Trump administration? What's your view?
Right. So I'm very aware that that is a concern of people, but I think we need to look further. I really truly believe that part of the reason we are where we are now is because we haven't challenged our incumbents enough. We haven't made sure that they are the very best that we have to offer our states and therefore our nation. So as we go forward, you know, we have to – I was at one time at a function, and Senator Nina Turner was there, and she made the comment that – any old blue just won't do. And mm-hmm. So when we're talking about taking on this administration, when we're talking about making sure that we are the party of the people, we have to make sure we're choosing the right blue, the blue that has people at the center of their platform, the blue that understands that they're non-negotiable, are the people, right? And so here are my major concerns with my opponent, and it's that he often will say that he is there fighting Trump, but many of the major concerns that people in Delaware have are the result of people he even agreed to appoint, such as Alex Azar with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, when we know he was a CEO of a pharmaceutical company and was okay with
oh dear,
charging exorbitant prices, right? Nielsen, when she is heading up this separation of families in Delaware, we consider ourselves a very immigrant-friendly state. This is something that doesn't set well with people here in Delaware. We have Rick Perry. We are the lowest lying state in the union. When he was running for president, he said that climate change was basically a hoax, right? And so and then you have Wilbur Ross, Secretary of Commerce, and the destruction that the financial industry has taken on, as we've seen how he's very much a recently it came out that he was taking money and so has a troubled background as far as taking care of people. And so when you're talking about electing someone just because they are a Democrat, that's not enough. We need the right person. We need the person who says, I am going to fight for the people at all times. I'm going to make sure that they are the center of my platform. I'm going to make sure that when I go to a table to negotiate legislation, that everybody knows that if it doesn't serve the people, then you might as well not even have a discussion yet. And we don't have that with Senator Carper. But I've proven, even though I'm not an elected official, that that is what I do, that I serve people without the expectation of anything in return, that I have, and I also have pledged not to take corporate money. And so even, let's just play devil's advocate. Let's say that corporate money does not, color a legislator's opinion and their vote. The perception alone is enough to ruin a democracy, and that's where we're heading now. People do not want corporate influence in our legislation, and we have to start making changes. And so all of those reasons are why I have to run, and other people need to challenge incumbents, because we have to, like Nina Turner said, we can't just think that any old blue will do. It won't, and we have to move forward.
So the appointments that you listed are Trump administration appointments that Senator Carper went along with. He supported that. He voted for those people. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow. Because, you know, I know what happens a lot is that people are like, well, you know, we just have to compromise a little, and this is what it is in a democracy. You don't always get exactly what you want. But, you know, the problem, it seems to me, as you've detailed, and I'm sure there are other instances of it, is that compromise is a very slippery slope. You know,
yes.
Once we kind of nod off, or, you know, we speaking as citizens kind of go, oh, well, there will inevitably be compromises. But we are not there vetting each compromise. We're not following it. We're kind of giving a rubber stamp approval. We're giving our trust to an elected official and saying, okay, I understand there'll be a little compromise, but unless we're really there bird dogging it, we aren't tracking those compromises and seeing where they lead, which is not away from the policies of the Trump administration, but actually deeper into the pit. And so that is a big problem, and it's really actually, I guess, I would submit that it's the job of the elected official to be looking at this very closely, to be very rigorous in not making the wrong compromises. And also the whole theme of compromise, or the purpose of compromise, is I give you a little on this, you give me a little on that. And, you know, that has been the spirit of compromise in a democracy, but we're way beyond that. You know, we're being bullied. It is irrational. The consequences are not being tallied. So this is not a time where anyone is giving back anything to the people for these compromises, you know. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your background, you know, in politics and government, in governance and social policy and in organizing?
Absolutely. And before I go into that, I just want to piggyback on what you said. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
Compromises is somewhat of the nature of the beast, but we've been losing. I believe that part of the reason we've been losing as a party is because we forgot what our non-negotiables should be. And as I stated earlier, it has to be the people. And so long as the president knows that we've forgotten that the people are our non-negotiables, he's constantly going to be able to step on us and influence the Republican Party to step on us. And we have to make sure we are electing people who know what they're bringing to the table. And there is no greater strength than the American people. And we need to understand that there is no corporation that is a human being. There never has been. And so they should not, a corporation should never outrank a citizen of the United States.
Can you maybe give us a few examples of the policies, you know, differences in your stance on policies that support the people versus your opponents?
Absolutely. Right off the bat, it's definitely healthcare. I have been fighting for healthcare for a while now. I fought to save it alongside many other people that I built coalitions with throughout the United States and in our state. We actually staged a total of 10,000 actions nationwide and on the Capitol combined. I wasn't at all of them, obviously, but I participated in making sure we arranged them, and we were able to save it. Unfortunately, the Trump administration undermined it to the point where it's almost becoming obsolete. But with that said, during that fight, Senator Carper failed to make a loud enough noise to make it clear how important it was for us to have health care. And when the drafting of the ACA was happening, he voted against the open market, which we know how important that is in creating a more stable Affordable Care Act. And while the Affordable Care Act is not what we want, it was an important starting point, and it just shows where what he was willing to do. And I've been pushing a Medicare for All system, and now Senator Carper is trying to mirror it. However, he has a very different stance. He says, well, eventually we'd like to get to that. The problem is you can't keep thinking about eventually because, of you know, while we're waiting for eventually, we're losing 18,000 people a year due to lack of health insurance. While you're waiting for eventually, you're talking about people having access, but access is a relative term. I can speak personally from that. My health care insurance jumped its copay from $12 to $60, which means I've had to put off health care for myself and my son because $60 every time we go to see a doctor is too much for me, and it's too much for most working class people. And so when you have a Cadillac health care insurance because you're sitting in Congress, you're not understanding what it's like to live in this post-recession economy and that every dollar really does count. So we definitely differ in where we want to go with health care. And it's not enough for him to mirror my policies. He has to push further and say he's going to give the best to Delawareans. And that's not just access to health care, but free health care. And we can afford it because we just have to reprioritize and put people first. Also, when it comes to financial regulation, I have the saying that it's a silent killer. You know, most
you
of us
what?
Don't pay attention. It's a silent killer for the working class.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us don't pay attention to finance regulation. It's a little bit boring. And it seems to be something outside of our realm. However, when we go to purchase a home, when we go to purchase a car, should we decide to start a small business, which is somewhat of you know, something that Americans tend to try to do at least one time in their lives, when you aren't paying attention to the financial system, you find out way too late what has happened. And Senate Bill 2155, which was recently passed this year, is something that Senator Carper signed on to that I opposed, I fought against, both on Capitol Hill with lobbying with people from our state and other senators. And I guess I'm stalling here just because it blows my mind that we have elected officials who don't understand, even though they were there when our financial industry gambled with the savings and well-being of the average American, lost that bet. We had to bail them out because they were, quote unquote, too big to fail. And then we put regulations in place. And then all of a sudden we take them back and say, you know what, you could try again. Go ahead and gamble with the future of America yet again. The future of the world, actually, because when we were destabilized, the rest of the world was destabilized. And this is essentially what Senator Carper signed on to and helped pass. Yes, Senate Bill 2155 greatly weakened Dodd-Frank. It brought back things such as the ability to redline. For the listeners that don't know what redlining is, you know, fresh out of Jim Crow, banks literally took maps, circled areas that were highly populated by communities of color, most specifically black people, and decided to make it so that they could only get certain mortgages, which lowered the value of those homes. And as a result, it stagnated intergenerational wealth within communities of color, again, most specifically black communities. Regulations were put in place to try to remedy this, and now with Senate Bill 2155, one of the deregulations is to say that they don't no longer have to report who they're giving mortgages to, so once again, it can make it so that communities of color are no longer receiving the funds they need to build intergenerational wealth, and this is something that just slipped through the system as if it was okay. It took away the ability of consumers to sue the credit reporting agencies should they lose their information, even if it makes it so that they now have poor credit for years to come and it makes it difficult for their lives to go on. But they made sure, and they called it the Community Banking and Consumer Protections Act. And yet they take away from consumers. The community banks, they list at having $250 billion worth of assets. Our community banks, such as Dover Federal Credit Union, have less than $500 million in assets. So, again, you're allowing these large corporate banks, Wells Fargo, M&T, to go on and on, threatening the strength, getting too big to fail yet again, but not allowing real community banks to compete, and therefore you lie to us once again with the name of an act, and then you say, hey, look what I passed, and then hidden within the bill is what destroys our communities. And you see
that's
this
a
on
favorite
and
tactic
on and
of
on.
Theirs. Yeah.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. Ed Carper is very well known for, well, not actually, he's not well known except for those of us who are really engaged in calling out legislators and saying, why did you make this vote? We see this also with environmental justice. Allison, he is adamant. You will not drill off the coast of Delaware. And I appreciate that. I don't want drilling off the coast of Delaware. But I also know if you drill off of the coast of Virginia or Florida, it's going to affect us. Right? But for him, he's not consistent with that. He allowed for the Keystone Pipeline. He allowed for drilling off of other coasts. And all of this, at the same time, he's getting an A rating from environmental groups. You can't have an A rating if you're not consistent about protecting the environment. With criminal justice reform, he prided himself on being tough on crime as a governor. He had the biggest prison expansion in state history, which ended up having more black and brown people locked up than in the history of the state of Delaware. Instead of investing and being tough on education and job opportunities and building infrastructure and encouraging businesses to come here, he chose to instead invest in a prison system to lock people away and destroy families. We have vastly different ideas of how we should go about changing our criminal justice system. For me, it is strengthening communities. For him, it is just expanding an industry that is getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier while the working class, and largely it's minority communities, but poor white people are affected in the same way. When I go down to Sussex, which is a largely white demographic, poor working class white people there have the same fears of people of color, regardless of their socioeconomic background. They're worried that the police will harass them. They're worried that they will get a record for something that is insignificant that will ruin the rest of their lives. We need to come together as communities and understand that we have to change the system. We have to make it more just and balanced, and we have to make sure that we have politicians that believe in strengthening communities, not just criminalizing people and making it so that they are consistently for the rest of their lives having to pay for an imbalanced justice system. And, I know we have some time to talk, but I don't want to take up every. I could go on and on about different things, but those are the main areas that people in Delaware are really concerned with. And my further concern is all of the other things that people aren't paying attention to, all of the other ways that corporations were put before the people of Delaware, all of the other ways that we see that bipartisanship did not help the people of Delaware, because we have a senator who is currently there who has had a long time to prove himself and build power, going to negotiating tables and not knowing that the people of Delaware must come first.
How long has he been in office, actually?
So he actually started as a senator in 2001. Prior to that, he was our governor. Prior to that, he was in the U.S. House of Representatives. And prior to that, he was a treasurer. So he started in, I believe it was 76, because it was a little before I was born, that he actually mm-hmm. started as a serving our state in different offices. So he is the mm-hmm. definition of a career politician. And I'm not – there are career politicians who've gone through and they still kept the heart of the people at the center of everything they do. Senator Carper has shown the opposite, and he's been consistent with it from the time he took office.
He's been consistent with, kind of putting a good face on things,
yes.
saying one thing, doing another, in the hope that people won't be looking that closely. They're too busy. They're not, you know, like the act that you mentioned, where
yes.
the name of it sounds good, but the substance therein is not good at all. And so, you know, he's kind of, and politicians do this, and government is complex, but counting on the fact that instead of, you know, kind of sussing out those hidden ringers that will be harming people in his state, and on their behalf, fighting to take them out of that particular legislation, instead he is putting a good face on it. He's a familiar figure, and, you know, but he's not looking out for the people in the ways that you're describing. Now, let me just ask another question, because this particular program, Connect the Dots, is broadcast out of the Northeast, and I mm-hmm. am not familiar with the population of Delaware. So I don't know whether you have a multi-tiered system in the state, if there are many affluent people and then a lot of people who are suffering economic hardship, as occurs, in many, many regions of the United States. Could you give us a picture of your population, of the people who will be deciding in this primary?
Absolutely. So Delaware is an interesting place. I always make the comment that we are almost the mirror image of the rest of the United States. We have mm-hmm. We have a red county, a blue county, a purple county. We have the haves and have-nots, meaning we have per capita the highest number of millionaires. We also have one of the highest percentages of people living in poverty. In fact, most of our school districts in this state, our students receive free breakfast and lunch every single day, to include on holidays. We have buses that go around and feed them because children are hungry. We have regular feeding programs through churches and other community organizations because our families are going without. And yet we have not enough industry. In New Castle County, we have a heavy banking industry. Kent County, where I live, mostly what we have are factories. We also have a casino. The same thing with Sussex. There's a couple chicken factories. There's a lot of farms. And then our major industry in Sussex is our tourism industry when the summer hits. We have people coming from around the world and throughout the nation. So, and then our demographics are pretty much, it varies depending on our county as well. But the key is, most people in the state of Delaware have only a high school diploma. And in fact, only 30% of our population has a bachelor's degree or higher, which is pretty consistent, again, with the rest of the United States. when it comes to healthcare, we have expanded our Medicaid system, but there are still that many people who do not have. And we have a lot of 29ers, meaning the people who are working part-time jobs but only get 29 hours a week, or else their large corporations would risk having to pay health care. And so they're struggling from job to job and still don't have health insurance. But we continue to pay out corporate welfare because instead of paying their people, we as taxpayers pay to make up the difference when it comes to things like health care and food stamps. And it's not because people want handouts. It's because we're allowing corporations to make record profits on the backs of the working class and not have them pay their fair share. But as you go through, again, our demographics are consistent with the rest of the United States. However, in Delaware, we're a small state. So we're very much relationship-based. You know, I often say that 6 degrees of separation quickly turns to 2 degrees of separation in the state of Delaware, and we're a bit frustrated. We're used to being able to talk to our neighbors. Our neighbors are our family, and because of our current administration, there's been a wedge that has been driven between us, and we can't communicate anymore. Something that has resounded with this campaign is that we've been very solution-based, as opposed to pointing fingers. We're saying this is what we need, and regardless of party, it's resonating. Regardless of demographic markers, it's resonating. And we keep getting told that these are extreme ideas, but when you talk to people in Delaware, they don't feel they're extreme at all. They feel they're necessary, and they feel that they deserve it, as does the rest of their community.
Mm-hmm. So actually, I mean, what I hear in that is that if and when you win the primary, you would stand in an excellent position in the general, both because of the fact that by demographic, Delaware is a solidly blue state. So this is a good state in which in which there's very low risk in going for a more progressive Democrat. And that secondly, you may have a situation where even Republicans cross the line and vote for a Democrat who is going to represent their interests, acknowledging that one of the reasons that many Republicans of lower economic background took the Trump lure is because of the hard times they're facing as a result of many years of both Democratic and Republican policy. And so that's a really interesting opportunity. And I guess there are two thoughts on that. One is for progressives who are committed to that agenda, I'm not asking for donations or anything like that, but this would be a good race to donate to, just commenting, because for people from anywhere, because it's kind of a more winnable reach than in a state where it could be argued that by not having the most conventional Democrat with as the Democratic candidate for Senate, there's really a very low bar risk in terms of the overall composition of the Senate, blue versus red on a broad stroke level. I'm also wondering if there has been voter registration activities in your state so that people who may perhaps have been underrepresented are able to participate in the upcoming September 6th primary. We, hear a lot about, more people should vote. The people who determined the election or the people who didn't vote, tell people to vote, tell people to vote. I'm going to send out postcards and tell people to vote. And, when I go on the ground and talk to people in different locations, what I hear is that they're not just ignorant people, lazy people who, didn't manage to vote, but actually they didn't see an opportunity for themselves in voting for the proffered candidates. Love to hear your thoughts on that, as well as are more people now registered as a result of your activities?
Right. So, we actually have a pretty high registration rate in Delaware. It's like 70-75%. But we have been registering more and more people who have never voted before. It's something I'm really proud of. I can say that I think there's one or two times I didn't. The majority of times that I've gone out canvassing, I personally had the honor of registering people for the very first time to vote. And I know that most of our field team has had the same type of experience. But something that is just as exciting is the number of people who are registered to vote but just stopped, who are now excited because they see someone who has their same experience. They see someone that it's not just an idea of remembering a story and saying, oh, you know, I met Bob and they felt this way, but knowing that I have that same problem. So the sense of urgency is really in me because I know it makes a difference for myself and my family. And they know that when somebody truly understands where they're coming from, they're more likely to fight harder. And so when I hear those stories and I hear people say, I believe you because you are me, basically, it just gives me that encouragement to keep pushing harder. I think that not only will winning this race immediately impact legislation because I will fight for all of the things that I said, it's going to impact what our future candidates look like. People are going to realize that they not only have the right, because many people feel like they're not entitled to run, right? Because they can't check off certain boxes. Not only do they have the right, but they have the ability to serve their state, to make sure that they're writing legislation and passing legislation that truly impacts their communities. It is imperative that people start to understand that there is a place for teachers to leave the classroom and step into the halls of Congress. There's a place for the lifetime retail worker. There's a place for the doctor, the lawyer, the community advocate. We have to have all voices present. It can't just be career politicians. It can't just be lawyers. It has to be people with diverse experiences so that our legislation is fully encompassing of all of our communities. Otherwise, we will continue to leave people in the margins when all of us deserve to be brought into the core.
Well, maybe we should cycle back to that earlier question that we never answered because we kind of got interested in other topics. Which is, you know, what is your background? You know, what background and experience do you bring to this coming in to this race?
Right. So I have a varied background. And, you know, while I was going through the motions of life, there were times when I was wondering, you know, did I do something wrong to have this experience? But, you know, I'm realizing that everything prepared me to be right where I am right now. You know, I am a veteran. I served during the Iraq War, OAF-OIF conflict, and I learned during that time in the service a few things. One was how amazing the military is. We move a mission flawlessly. We become brothers and sisters in arms. And it doesn't matter if we're black, white, Asian, Spanish, if we're from the north, south, east, or west, male, female, gay, straight, we push the mission. That is our focus. And we become family. The military has been the spearhead of change for the most part in our country. We saw that the integration of troops predated integration in society. We saw that men working alongside women predated men working alongside women in society. We saw that there was a lot more openness with people serving in the military that were gay before it was allowed in the civilian world. And we're going to see a lot more changes like that. And the military leads the way because we learn with our time in the service that if you're focused on the end result, it doesn't matter all of the things that we've been taught growing up that to divide us because we find what unites us. But I also learned some hardships. You know, I learned the hard lessons that life has to teach you, and that is that the tolls of war are real, and they're not just monetary. They are painful and emotional. The loss of life is real, and it's not just with the ultimate sacrifice of death, but people have wounds that they will carry with them forever, and it affects entire families. I learned how important it is to have legislators who don't just act off of emotion and anger, but really look to why we are sending our young men and women, mostly working class, to war. And I know that it angers me, and the more I serve, that we went into a conflict based on a lie, and then we had to clean it up, and we left behind a country that was in more turmoil than when we arrived, and it made me really question how we deal with foreign policy and how we intercede in all of our foreign relations. And I am very concerned with our current administration. Trump, I believe, is disrupting alliances that we need not just for our safety but for the advancement economically of our country. And he is pushing away lifelong allies, and that is a danger. And he is creating new enemies. And we really have to consider what effect that has on our country. But as I went further, I ended up getting medically retired from the Air Force. I got sick from the anthrax vaccine, and I had a rough time when I first left the military. It was very difficult to find a job. It was post-recession economy. I ended up finding a job that wasn't – I wasn't able to work full-time. I was one of the 29ers. I literally was frying chicken at a local gas station, cutting lawns, cleaning basements, whatever I could do to make ends meet, but it still wasn't enough. And thank God that I have a family that is close and that they were able to help pick up the slack, because if it weren't for them, I would have been homeless, but part of the working homeless. I would have been working and probably living in my car, but I wouldn't have been able to afford to stay in a home. I wouldn't have been able to afford to move forward. I ended up eventually landing a full-time job as an auto body mechanic, blue-collar work, understanding just how heavy a toll that takes on your body, between the chemicals you're exposed to and just the labor. It shortens your work life, so to speak. You don't get to go to 65 and still be able to walk properly. And I saw how that really disrupted the gentleman I work with, because I was the only woman in a all male shop, which is generally what happens with that type of industry. But I also learned how important it was to have conversations. You know, there were people I worked with that had Confederate flag shirts and belt buckles and things, and being able to have the conversation, explaining why, how it affected me and how they felt, and creating friendships through things that in the past I might have shied away from, learning to suspend my propensity for defensiveness in order to have a conversation, and seeing how that created bonds that will be forever in place, that I would have lost had it not been for the fact that I was willing to have those conversations, and as were the people I worked with. And that's also much of the basis of my campaign, is knowing that if you continuously have the conversations that people shy away from, but show where you stand and why, you actually bring people to the table to want to speak with you, even if at first you don't understand or don't agree. In the end, that's what compromise is. In the end, we all end up feeling like winners and have an understanding of where each other comes from. And I ended up having to go into a place where people did have Confederate flags and stuff, to a place where they didn't, because they respected how it made me feel. And it was just an amazing experience. And to the point where there was even a guy who almost joined the KKK. He came up to me in a conversation that was just so normal and was like, "Hey, Carrie, I'm thinking of joining the KKK." And it just kind of blew my mind inside. But instead of freaking out, and I was calm and said, "Oh, okay, well, you know, what makes you want to do that? And you know, they're a racist organization." And he says, "No, it's different now. They're a community organization. It's more like a social club, right?" And I said, "Are you sure about that?" And he says, "Yes." And this is a guy who had it rough with his family, and the KKK, like any other gang-type organization, they find people who don't have close connections. And they tried to prey on him, and we discussed it, and I told him, I said, you've come to embrace everything that I am, right? Because I'm a whole lot of otherness is my joke, right? I'm gay, I'm a woman, I am a person of color." And so he says, "Yeah." And I said, I just, if that's what you want to do, I support you. But I honestly believe that in a few months they're going to tell you to hate everything that you have come to love. And he says, Carrie, I really disagree with that. And I said, oh, that's fine. I said, but I said, you know, if that's what you feel you need to do, then you should go for it. And then we never discussed it again. We went on with things as normal. And then sure enough, a few months later, he came up and let me know. He said, Carrie, you were right. He said, you know, after they thought that I was more comfortable, they started to talk about some things that I didn't agree with. And so that moment taught me that sometimes you just have to be patient. Again, suspend your propensity for defensiveness. Explain where you come from, and then, you know, kill him with love. If I had just shunned him for even having the idea of joining the KKK, we would have had one more person that was, you know, a white nationalist that somebody didn't have the conversation with them to explain that this isn't true, that we are all better off when we work together. Mm-hmm. And then I got the amazing opportunity to become a full-time organizer. And even though throughout this time, and I left this part out, I was always volunteering and organizing. I was appointed to the State Human Relations Commission by the governor to help deal with discrimination in public places, things like that. But you know, people always tell you, you know, if you ever find a job that you love, you'll never work another day in your life. And it just kind of sounds like a phrase, like it's a pretty quote. But when I got to do community organizing full time, it really did feel like that. I have never worked so hard in my life. And, you know, in the military where we got to have our days wavered to 28-hour days without rest, or, you know, as an auto body mechanic, you know, working 16-hour days in the extreme heat and things like that, it did not equate to just the random hours of community organizing. You never really know. All of a sudden something hits and you have to build a coalition really quickly to combat something, either nationally or statewide. Having the varying hours because you have to meet people where they are, and sometimes some people only have the ability to meet at 11 at night or 6 in the morning, and you're going to make it happen because you have to make sure that they're a part of the system. Helping to draft policy with people from different, from across the nation and different time zones, it's very volatile, but the impact that you see it having, especially when you have seen somebody go from somebody that just complains about a situation to now advocating for themselves, it is a beautiful feeling and a beautiful thing to see. And we have a saying as organizers, you're not doing your job if you're not working your way out of a job. And every time I've worked my way out of a job as an organizer, I was so excited, even though I suddenly was without money and had to find another way to make money. But it was always, you knew that mission was accomplished. And it's something that I plan to continue doing even as a senator, is to make sure we're constantly organizing, where people aren't feeling, again, that an elected official only shows up at election time. For me, part of my staff will always be field organizers, knocking on doors, hearing what the community is saying. I can't be at all places, but my team can be. And when I need to show up and use my platform to draw attention to something happening in our communities, my team will say, Carrie, you need to come. And I will come and I will help energize the electorate to help advocate for themselves. I'm really excited about that opportunity when it comes.
Wow, that's fantastic. You know, this is really, I mean, in this nugget of what you're sharing about organizing, you're really getting to the essence of what has to change that on the local level, and then, you know, move up regionally, nationally, federally, globally. You know, I spend time in different communities, and I can see tremendous contrast in terms of what people think they can do, they should do, they must do. You know, I see a lot of people in despair about the current administration who have no clue about what to do other than maybe ask psychological questions about what, you know, what would lead people on the Republican side to feel and believe and act and vote as they do. And, you know, your interaction with your coworker in the body shop shows greater emotional intelligence, greater humanity that comes from working with and mingling with and caring about a wide different spectrum of people, you know, than people kind of standing by and wringing their hands. And I've heard a lot of that. You know, to reconfigure public office to include that level of citizen involvement. And it's not just I put out my PR team, my press team goes out and blows a horn and says what I do. And then, or I have a canned speech, you know, that some sophisticated marketers have put together to, you know, tell the public that I've minutely shifted my opinion here or there in a way that reassures them and puts them to sleep again. No, what you're describing is true engagement, ongoing engagement, to solve our society's problems, you know, for our region, for our state, for the national government, because we're involved in working with other people. It's like an organizer model. You know, for people who, you know, maybe might be listening to the show, don't have a clue what an organizer is or does. They've never kind of met one. They've maybe just attended a few cocktail party fundraisers or whatever. You know, they just really don't. And I say this because I go through different communities, including high net worth ones, where, you know, trust me, that exists. And the people really are unhappy about the Trump administration. But they, you know, they think that they have to be like a shrink for, you know, someone, a poor person, someone suffering economically on, you know, with Republican or racist beliefs, and that's their only avenue. I mean, tell us, you know, what is an organizer?
So what all is organizing? Of us have the ability to be an organizer. So here's the thing, and I will tell people all the time. One, words without action are mute. So if you see a problem, start working on fixing the problem. But you but I really honestly believe that we have the most strength in the areas that we're the most passionate about. If you are moved by environmental issues, then study, form coalitions, and push for change in environmental justice. Same thing with criminal justice and education reform and tax reform. We all have something that motivates us a bit more. But you have to also be ready and willing as an organizer to understand that all of our struggles are connected. So when somebody calls you that is outside of your area of passion, you have to show up for their thing as well. Because in order to heal our society, we have to work in multiple areas at once. But start small. You don't have to go and help draft legislation right away. If you're noticing that people are speeding through a specific street and the kids are playing in that street, advocate with your community council, get petitions signed, and make sure there's a stop sign put in place. If you're noticing that you are having more and more people discussing the possibility of aligning with white nationalists and you feel that that is not the correct way to go, and then start having the uncomfortable conversations. And don't do it with a whole group. Start with one person, but in a way that doesn't make them feel judged. Maybe just ask them where they're coming from. And don't feel the need to tell them where you're coming from yet. Those conversations make way for the next thing. And again, kind of like I did with my friend, let them know that if that's their choice, that's okay, but this is where you stand and why. It'll more so than you think. It will stick with them. They will remember it when they're in other conversations. If you point out without judgment where you differ from them. The more involved you get, you will start building networks. Go to different community organizations, events. Meet people. Learn what drives them. Get their contact information. Every once in a while, make sure you follow up with a text message, an email, a lunch or coffee. So that when it comes time, when you see a problem, you know who to call to build a coalition to fix that problem. as you go further, you'll get more and more involved with coalitions. You'll start discussing more with locally elected and state elected officials, and then eventually nationally elected officials. You'll learn what makes them tick. You'll realize that there is an issue that you want to drive, but in order to get them to jump on board, you have to find out why they should support it, what their opposition is going to say, and how what the best way is for them to draft legislation. More times than not, you would be surprised that a lot of legislation that goes before our state legislators and before Congress is drafted by the public, and then they expand upon it while once they receive it. Most of our legislators are overworked. People are throwing ideas at them all the time. If you come to them with an idea that is already partially drafted, you'll go a long way. And at first, you will have no idea how to do it. But when you build those coalitions, you build your network, then you will quickly learn more and more and more about how to influence legislation from the local up to the national level. And these coalitions are what builds power. We're always hearing in America that it's not what you know, but who you know, and that means that also goes for the working class. We have become powerless because we've lost connection with one another. Build that network, build that power, and amplify your voice, because one voice alone doesn't do much. But when we show up, you know, races, even on the national level nowadays, are won by a couple hundred votes. If you show up with 100 people, it's going to scare somebody. It's going to make them act, and it's going to make them act in the benefit of you, and that's what we need to change. And so don't think too big at first. Ease your way into it, and I promise you, when you see these changes happening, you will be moved to do more. You will see your community coming together, and you will see your good works becoming fruitful.
Beautiful. Wow, that is fantastic. What a great primer for revivifying, you know, reviving ourselves as citizens. That is absolutely fantastic. You know, what we've had, really, as you speak, it becomes just clearer and clearer that, you know, we have applied the business model to the public service ethic model, and just the line between the two has just, you know, with Citizens United, but even before and even since, it has moved where what used to be the public trust, public service, you know, the altruistic model of service and government has become a business proposition where candidates can't fear losing their job, they can't be elected, because instead of depending on the people, they're depending on these donors. And then these donors drive the policies and the politics. And so it's you know, voting for a progressive candidate like you, Evelyn Harris, running for the Senate in the state of Delaware, and or even contributing to your campaign, no matter where a listener might live in the country, if they would be interested in doing that, you know, that is a way of taking back that power that always belonged to us, that we ceded through our inactivity, through our inertia, through our acceptance of, you know, the core compromise is not, you know, as Senator Carper did, voting for the Iraq War, and then, as he later said, I'm so sorry. That's not a compromise, you know. The compromise is allowing business entrepreneurship to overwhelm government and civic duty and responsibility, and the prescription of putting an organizer and an organizing model for citizenship back into place, is really the solution to what ails us. And so it's not just one person over another. It isn't just a series of issues, which are extremely important, every single one of them, because it makes a big difference in people's lives. Their health care, the millions and trillions of dollars devoted to military, the investment in prisons rather than in people and communities, all of those things make a difference. But, you know, it can be that anyone listening resonates with one issue and not with another issue. So, you know, there may be issues that we don't all agree about or we care about more or less passionately. But I think that everyone has to care about this overwhelming of a business model of government, because we no longer have a democracy. And, you know, it's all kind of heading downhill. So relying on the old formula is really, you know, and believing, oh, we just have to do that, is really living in the past and not building a future. So, you know, and you're really laying out a pathway, and it's not just, you're not just laying it out because you thought of it yesterday. You're laying it out because this is what you do. This is what you've done. You've lived it. You've learned from it. You've been doing it with other people. Other people are using this model to further that and put it on the road and let others join with it. So I just want to thank you so much, Carrie Evelyn Harris, for being with us today. I don't suppose that anyone listening to the program, if you listeners reside in the state of Delaware, you won't be in a confusing position in terms of, you know, what you want to decide. You can figure that out, how you want to vote. Anyone listening elsewhere, you know, might want to think about kind of putting a little more shekels, against this ugly corporate model that has left us in such dire straits. So, you know, thank you so much. And September 6th is the primary day in the state of Delaware. We'll be looking forward to what happens there and following that closely. And thank you for running and for your years of hard work and service and for being with us today on Connect the Dots.
Oh, and thank you so much, Allison. I really do appreciate it. And I just want to say to all the listeners, just remember that we've been denied, but we are truly qualified to serve our communities. And please don't let me be the only one that does this. Please step up. Know that you have the abilities and the heart of your people in mind. And if that's the case, make it happen. And I'll be there to support you.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This has been a true pleasure and a real inspiration. And good luck
Thank
on September
you.
6th. Good luck to all of us on September 6th, because
yes.
I think having
yes.
you in the Senate can make a huge difference for all the things that so many of us care about. And we look forward to that happening. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on this week's Connect the Dots. Again, I'm journalist Allison Rose Levy. Be well. Keep marching forward in company with all our relations. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time.
Well, who, well?